strong enough to kill everyone within a mile of Ground Zero who was unprotected by walls or other objects that could block ultraviolet and infrared rays. Serious burns were possible at a distance of 2 miles. Thick clothing offered some protection because the flash lasted less than a second. White clothes tended to reflect thermal radiation, while darker colors absorbed it. A number of victims suffered flash burns that mimicked the dark and light patterns of their kimonos. The effects of ionizing radiation, primarily gamma rays emitted during the first minute after detonation, were even more disturbing. Perhaps one-fifth of the deaths at Hiroshima and Nagasaki were due to radiation sickness. People who'd survived the blast and the fires soon felt nauseated and tired. Some became ill within hours, while others seemed perfectly healthy for days before feeling unwell. Gamma rays had damaged the ability of their cells to replicate. The symptoms preceding their deaths were horrific: fever, vomiting, delirium, bloody diarrhea, internal bleeding, bleeding from the eyes and the mouth. For decades, some historians have questioned whether the use of atomic bombs was necessary. They have argued that Japan was already militarily defeated, that the blockade of Japanese ports had strangled the country's economy, that an American invasion would never have been required, that a conventional bombing campaign alone could have forced a surrender, that the Soviet Union's declaration of war on Japan had a greater impact than the atomic bombs, that a demonstration of one atomic bomb would have provided a sufficient shock to the Japanese psyche, that a promise the emperor could retain his throne would have saved hundreds of thousands of lives. These counterfactual arguments, though compelling, can never be proved. But the historical facts remain. Hiroshima was destroyed on August 6th. 2 days later, the Soviet Union declared war on Japan. Nagasaki was struck on the 9th, and the following day, General Korichika Anami, the Minister of War, still urged the Japanese people to fight, even though we have to eat grass and chew dirt and lay in the field. On August 14th, Emperor Hirohito overruled his generals and agreed to an unconditional surrender. "The enemy has for the first time used cruel bombs," he explained, "and the heavy casualties are beyond measure." Potential hazards. For a moment, Powell and Plum just stood there, stunned, looking down at the fuel pouring out of the missile and the white mist floating upward, reaching level 6, level 5, level 4. "Oh my God," Plum thought. "We've got to get the hell out of here." Powell radioed the control center. "There's some kind of white, milky substance in the air at level 7, he said. "And that's all," he said. Captain Mazzaro told the PTS team chief, Charles Heineman, that his men should leave the silo immediately. Heineman ordered them to evacuate and return to the blast lock. Powell motioned to Plum, "Let's go." The missile was now shrouded in fuel vapor, and the cloud was approaching the platform where they stood. Mazzaro was puzzled. He wondered what this white substance could be. He thought about the maintenance that had been performed in the silo earlier in the day. What could the stuff be? He didn't want to notify the command post at Little Rock Air Force Base until he had a better idea of what was happening. Mazzaro asked Heineman, who was sitting nearby, if he could think of anything. The klaxon went off, and the fuel vapor launch duct light on the commander's console began flashing red. Powell and Plum left the silo and closed the door. Powell wanted to take the elevator down to a lower level, look at the base of the missile, and assess the damage. But the team chief ordered him and Plum to get out of the cableway and enter the blast lock, where the backup team was stationed. Roger Hamm and Gregory Lester opened blast door 9 for them, let them in, and then Lester quickly pulled it shut. They popped the helmets off their Refcos as Hamm locked the door. Powell threw the wrench handle onto the floor and cursed. Mazzaro turned off the klaxon. The fuel vapor launch duct light made no sense. Why would that come on when the PTS crew was pressurizing the Stage 2 oxidizer tank? He asked for vapor readings from the mine safety appliance, which were displayed on a panel in the blast lock. Three old-fashioned gauges there showed the vapor levels in the silo. Needles on the gauges moved to the right as the amount of vapor increased. The PTS team reported that the oxidizer level was 10 parts per million, and the fuel vapor level was 40 parts per million, almost the maximum reading. One of those gauges had to be wrong. There couldn't be fuel vapors and oxidizer vapors in the silo at the same time. The two would have mixed and caused an explosion. Mazzaro wondered which gauge was correct. Then the needle on the fuel vapor gauge surged all the way to the right, and the MSA spiked. The klaxon went off again, and Al Childers looked up. He'd ignored it the first time, but now realized that something was wrong. He was sitting at a table behind the commander's console, filling out paperwork that recommended his student, Miguel Serrano, for another alert. Suddenly the console was lit up like a Christmas tree. Rows of warning lights were flashing red. Then Childers heard somebody say there was a fire in the hall, got up from the table, grabbed a copy of the Dash 1, searched the manual for the fire checklist, found it, and started going through each step. Now the spray lights were lit, which meant that the fire suppression system had been automatically triggered. Thousands of gallons of water were pouring into the launch duct. Childers pushed the surface warning control button, turning on the red beacon topside, and contacted the PTS team up there. Eric Ayala was in his Refco suit, standing near the nitrogen tank on the hard stand, when he heard over the radio that Powell and Plum were backing out of the silo. Then he heard fire in the hall, and Childers ordering everyone topside to evacuate the site. Ayala and his partner, Richard Willinghurst, quickly took off their Refcos. The third member of the team, David Adderhold, was sitting in a truck parked near the access portal, monitoring the radio. The truck held four extra Refcos, air packs, Dewar units to refill them with air, and a portable shower. After hearing the order to evacuate, he helped Ayala and Willinghurst pack up their suits. Everyone jumped into the truck, leaving an empty pickup behind, and then Willinghurst drove toward the gate. A white cloud floated from the silo exhaust shaft, like smoke rising from a chimney.